Good morning. Welcome to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your co-host for today's program, Prentice Pemberton. The words, "I am a nationalist," were spoken 2 days ago by the President of the United States. Your actions seem to be divided into three schools of thought. There are many who were horrified by the leader of the free world declaring his allegiance to an ideology that has long been associated with the Nazi movement and extreme right-wing hate groups. There's another group who are visible at his rallies and make up the core of Trump's base that cheer wildly and seem to view Trump as the anointed one who will lead America back to a place of national pride and will protect the traditional values that America is founded upon. The third group is those that just don't seem to care and are indifferent to the attitudes and words of the president and say, well, it's just Trump being Trump. Watching this division, this high conflict political environment marked by a struggle for power and control, I can't help but compare it to an ugly divorce in which the children are manipulated and lied to in order to assure their devotion. We the people are the children, and we are suffering from their dysfunction. How have we gotten to this place? How have we arrived at a place where the only things that unify us as a people are natural disasters and images of babies being taken from their families at the border? How have we come to this time in our history where the President of the United States uses fear, bullying, intimidation, and verifiable lies as tactics to hold power? How have we gotten to the point where our political system is essentially gridlocked due to the venomous accusations, acts of intimidation, and blame game being perpetrated by both sides? And finally, what, if any, are the costs to the social and emotional fabric of our society and the foundations that have, some would argue, made us the beacon on the hill for the tired, the weary, and the hungry from the world over? On today's program, I'm once again joined by philosophy professor and author, Dr. David Livingstone Smith. Dr. Livingstone Smith has researched and written extensively on the subject of war, human cruelty, and genocide, and was a guest at the G20 Economic Summit in 2012, where he spoke about dehumanization and mass violence. Welcome back to Line One, Dr. Livingstone Smith. I appreciate you taking the time to come back.
Well, thank you, Prentice. I appreciate your inviting me back to talk with you about this very important topic.
All right. Stay tuned with us for the next hour as we discuss the political discord in our country and discuss the impacts it's having on our institutions and on the social health and wellness of our nation. If you have a question or a comment about today's topic, we'd love to hear from you. In Anchorage, our phone number is 550-8433. You can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752, or you can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. All right. Do I call you, is it Dr. Livingstone Smith? Is it Dr. Smith? I've seen it both ways.
It's Smith, but I prefer David.
Okay. Well, then we'll go with David. Okay. So tell us a little bit about your background and your area of research for those that our last show was dehumanization, or your book. It was about your book on dehumanization and why we exterminate and other people. And it was a really thoughtful conversation, and we're hoping to kind of build on this. But what is your background and what is your area of research that led me to sort of invite you to talk about this topic in particular?
Well, I've had really two careers. My first career was as a psychotherapist and a trainer of psychotherapists. That's when I lived in the United Kingdom in London. And I eventually transitioned to philosophy. So I'm a professor of philosophy at the University of New England in Maine. But my research isn't what a lot of people would associate particularly with philosophy.
Okay.
My interests, and this has been the case for about a decade now, have been concerned with race, racism, dehumanization, political propaganda, ideology, and this sort of thing, which I want to address not in a purely conceptual way, but I want to address in ways that actually give us some grip on what goes on in the world, and hopefully what we can do about some of these terrible things that go on in the world.
All right, you mentioned a term, and I did too, dehumanization. Can you let our audience know and listeners know what operationally what that means?
Sure. So the term dehumanization is used in lots and lots of different ways. And it's very, very easy to people to talk past each other when they're talking about dehumanization because it's so unclear. So if you Google the word dehumanization, you'll get around 8 million hits. And these are quite varied in nature. So some people equate dehumanization with racism or with denigration or with lack of respect and so on. I use the term in a very, very specific way. When we dehumanize others, we conceive of them as subhuman creatures. And that has been something which we have found in virtually every genocide, in war, in wartime propaganda, and in all sorts of forms of oppression. So it's a morally very, very serious thing to study because it's bound up with some of the worst things that human beings have done to one another over the course of our history.
And it's the language is important. You taught me about that in reading your book. The language is so important, how we talk about nests of terrorists or vermin or crawling, you know, as this caravan is going to infiltrate and, you know, consume our country.
Swarming across the border.
Swarming across the border, yes. Just that's the giving humans characteristics or qualities that make them less than.
Yes, I've used examples like that, as you mentioned in my book, Less Than Human. It's been the immigration from south of the border has been described, for instance, as a brown tide, which captures the racialization
right.
of people from Latin America, and also the sense that they are not individuals. You know, a brown tide is like a swarm. It's a mass rather than being understood as a bunch of desperate people trying to get a better life.
Yeah, mass, a brown tide brings up images of something sinister, kind of like the red tide or, you know, some dangerous thing. So the term, I used it, and when I heard the president say, I guess I am a nationalist, and he did it obviously knowingly because he, you know, spoke, I'm not supposed to say this. And but can you, I mean, what's the difference between nationalism and patriotism? I think that's an important term that we understand a little bit. Why is that nationalism caused such an uproar?
Both of those terms are kind of vague or ambiguous, I should say. And they're rather emotionally charged, but they're differently historically burdened. So the idea of patriotism is generally understood as an attitude of loyalty or love for one's nation. So there's a more, perhaps a more benign set of associations. That doesn't mean that patriotism is benign or is always benign, but certainly it doesn't conjure up what nationalism does.
I have images of parades and celebrations and, you know, flyovers at the ball game, patriotism.
Mm-hmm. So look, patriotism, the notion of patriotism is perfectly compatible with protest and civil disobedience.
Yeah.
So one could reasonably say one is patriotic if one objects to what one's government is doing. But nationalism is not like that. So nationalism is associated with far-right movements, with a fascist style of politics. That's a strongman politics, which also involves sort of an us and them polarization, and the exercise of power. So that's really what nationalism suggests. It's America first. It's loyalty to the state as is embodied in the strongman leader. And it's the exercise of power, or maybe more specifically of dominance, because power, of course, can be constructive and benign. This nationalism conjures up the image of raw power and domination and self-interest.
And it's, I mean, I started off talking about Trump, but this isn't about Trump. I mean, this is a sort of a worldwide sweep right now of a return to older sort of attitudes of mind and a lot of this sort of us against them and tribalism sort of. I mean, is that accurate to say it's happening in other areas of the world? And
certainly is. It's okay. Happening in Turkey and Hungary and Germany, in Austria, in Poland, and most recently in Brazil. So, yes, there is an alarming rise of authoritarianism worldwide, and I include our country in that phenomenon.
And what are the characteristics of an authoritarian regime? That was a little bit later in the conversation, but this seems like an appropriate time since it's happening across the world, and you included America in that category now, which is a unique or new company for us, I suppose. Why is that? Why is that statement?
So I think what's if I can sort of work my way towards that.
Sure.
So if we just concentrate on this country, which is the country I know best, I don't think there's anything radically new in the sentiments that are going around. What's happened is that a kind of set of tensions, which have always been there in American society, have become explicit. Now, we have a kind of a chicken or the egg situation here. So certainly Donald Trump has given permission for certain of these views and sentiments and attitudes to become explicit.
He did not create them.
No, he did not. He's a symptom, but he's also a cause, right? So he kind of has liberated them, and that's very, very powerful because, you know, when people can authentically say what they believe, it's an extraordinarily liberating experience for them. And so the things, the attitudes that people had, the things that they would say in the privacy of their homes or with their buddies in bars or out on hunting trips or whatever, but which would be unacceptable in public or in polite society, are now things that can be said publicly, right? And so that's powerful, and that's, of course, authenticity is always liberating for the people who experience it. But of course, the same people have created a situation in which there is someone in power, namely Donald Trump, who licenses, largely by his example, this sort of discourse. So that's why I say Trump is a symptom, but he's also a cause. There's kind of a feedback loop here. Now, authoritarianism, there are different forms of authoritarianism. So what I have in mind most generally is government in which the state is associated with an individual, and that individual typically promises some sort of, maybe it's a bit too strong, but maybe not extremely too strong, a sort of return to the time when everything was okay. So when a society is rent by conflicts and tensions, when things are changing very, very quickly, particularly when formerly marginalized groups are asserting themselves, there can be this nostalgic longing on the part of those who feel that they're being left out, a longing for the past. And the leader, the authoritarian leader, typically exploits that longing and promises a return to the past, the mythical past, of course, because if we look at history, there's never been a time when things are okay for everybody. So and the so past here is imagined largely.
The statement, I mean, just the whole campaign, Make America Great Again, stamped on the hat. Is that what you're talking about? That idea of taking us back to a time where there were those parades and national pride, and we were the shining beacon. I mean, that's the promise, right?
Allegedly, yeah. We were never the shining beacon, but we'd like to imagine ourselves as the shining beacon. Back to a time when women had no opportunities for careers. Maybe back to the time when they couldn't vote. Back to the time when Black people were horribly oppressed. It all depends upon where you stand.
Right.
What counts as the era when America was great.
That is the mythical piece. That's the promise, right?
Promise. That's what the leader promises to deliver. So the leader becomes sort of a messianic figure. There's salvation at hand. Follow me and there's salvation at hand.
Why is fear so necessary? Why is it that is what is driving most of the conflict in our country right now is fear and us and them?
Yeah, well, look, to a great extent, politics as it's actually practiced, particularly in a political system like we have here, is a kind of salesmanship. Yeah. To sell something, you have to motivate people. And fear is a tremendous motivator. So if you can elicit fear, and actually elicit depression as well, that's another powerful mechanism. In my studies on propaganda, those two states of mind play a very, very important role. If you can cultivate distress and then promise a solution, promise a cure, people swallow your promises a lot more readily than if you just start with a constructive or positive message.
There has to be, as you said, a marginalized people. There has to be a percentage, a portion of the population that feels left behind for this sort of approach to take hold, right? To take root. And middle America, it seems like, feels like they have been left behind by the East Coast, by the progressives, by the, you know, we're losing our identity and our culture. And those are all very, you know, the welfare and the, you know, the health and the social economic status of middle America has gone down. And so there was, I mean, not recently under Trump, he's actually kind of revitalized some of those things by going back to old manufacturing stuff and coal and the oil. But those people, I mean, there's 30% of the population that will do, that will believe whatever he says. That is their truth. And they can't just be ignored, right? That is,
no,
if they're not healthy, then our whole population is not healthy.
Yeah, yeah, no, they can't be ignored. Well, like you said, believe everything he says. Maybe that's a slight exaggeration, but I don't think it's too far. There are certainly those people who idealize him to that extent. And that is also a kind of attitude that the authoritarian leader cultivates. If you want to establish an authoritarian regime, one of the things you have to do is undermine normal norms for distinguishing truth from falsity. And so it has to be the case that what the leader says defines what's true. I mean, we can see this in very extreme form, say, in North Korea. The leader is the arbiter of what is true and what is false. And what is true is whatever the leader wills. So you can see it almost as something theological. The leader is like God or God's representative on earth. The leader creates reality, and the leader is capable of saving us, poor, desperate, suffering human beings.
That is the attacks on the media, on the academics, mm-hmm. on the thinkers, right, from the progressive side. That's what that does. Yeah. Is his
sure.
Don't listen to them. It's nonsense.
Universities, the academics. Universities are the places devoted to figuring out what's true and what isn't, right?
Right.
So authoritarian regimes virtually always attack the intelligentsia, the universities, you know, the places where that happens. The universities are seats of resistance. And so, yes, that's part of it, but also the persistent lying, the persistent painting fanciful pictures of reality, of just stating things, for instance, that there are ISIS terrorists in the caravan headed towards our southern border.
Yeah, and maybe the Democrats set it up.
Yes, yes, yes. Maybe the Democrats at that. Now, with that sort of discourse, things get particularly sinister.
Yeah. Okay, if you're just joining us, my guest today is Dr. David Livingstone Smith, who is a professor of philosophy at the University of New England and the author of several books on the topic of war, genocide, dehumanization, and human cruelty. Today, we are discussing the political discord in our country and the potential impacts on our institutions and on the social health and wellness of our nation. After this short break, I'll let you know how to reach us, and we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Smith. I'm Prentice Pemberton, and this is Line One, your health connection.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line One on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just joining us, my guest today is philosophy professor and author Dr. David Livingstone Smith. He's the author of several books on the topic of war, genocide, dehumanization, and human cruelty. Today, we are discussing the political discord in our country and the impacts it's having on our institutions and on the social health and wellness of our nation. If you'd like to join today's conversation, you can email your questions or comments to line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us in Anchorage at 550-8433, and you can reach us outside of Anchorage on our toll-free number at 1-888-353-5752. All right. Well, let's go ahead. We have a caller who has a question I think will be relevant to our conversation. So, Doug, you're on line one. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Thanks. I appreciate your opening comments there, Prentice, and today's discussion with you, David. I just want to point out that the rhetoric and political discord that you're referencing has escalated in the past few days to very real bomb threats. And the one comment I really have for listeners is, vote, and I'll take your response offline.
Okay. David?
Yeah, well, he's absolutely right. I've been following the news with great apprehension, even though this does not surprise me. I think we're at a very, very dangerous point in our history. I've been saying this till I was blue in the face for the last 2 or 3 years. And I'm afraid I'm not as optimistic as many are about the midterm elections. I'm afraid that there will not be this blue wave that's being predicted.
Right.
And immediately after the Kavanaugh hearings, actually, I was my suspicion is that a lot of Democrats view Kavanaugh as a victim of political correctness,
right,
and so on, and are secretly sympathetic and may not vote the way the demographics suggest they will vote. So I agree with your caller. Vote. But of course, when I say that, I say, please vote the way I would like you to vote.
Yes, we are voting, and that is how we have our elected officials, and that's the way that America works in our democracy, yeah. Right? So, I mean, if the majority of the country is wanting this then and voting this way, then I guess we have to figure out how to change it. And maybe it's just the pendulum swing, and I do want to get into that. That is this just the political pendulum swing and a backlash from the years of progressive and liberal thinking? But I do want to take another phone call. I think is again quite relevant. Somebody in listening in Wasilla, go ahead.
Hey, I'm trans and I'm dealing with this huge barrage of just continued threats.
Yeah,
and it just seems like. It just seems like people are being exhausted by these small threats and small movements, and it's just sort of slowly walking the line further and further, and it's really hard to get people around me to really see anything because they're just seeing these small actions. But it's really becoming exhausting and terrifying, and it seems like we're being targeted, not so much because we're like a threat or anything like that, but just because it seems like we're an easy target, maybe because we're harmless, really. And I don't know what you had to think you had to say about that.
I really appreciate the question. I think what you're—I mean—you make a good point that there hasn't been a lot of violence against folks by the trans community, and it's not a dangerous group of folks that don't—you know—it's not a threat. So why are they being attacked, Dr. Smith? What is—is there just a group of others?
Well, no, I think it's a little bit more than that. I think they symbolize something. So trans people are seen as a trans people are seen as a threat, but not as a physical threat.
Right.
There's a threat to what many people think of as a sort of a stable order, where men are men and women are women, and these categories are rigidly sustained. And one of the threats when things are changing very quickly is these traditional orders start dissolving.
Right.
And that causes people to feel very displaced and disturbed, right? And so there's an immense, I think, symbolic significance to trans people, and trans people are attacked for that reason. And yes, I mean, I've made my point.
Yeah, that's a great call, and I appreciate I appreciate you sharing that with us. And I think that's a great point, Dr. Smith, that trans people represent really a progressive thinking, you know, freedom to be yourself and express yourself as you feel comfortable. So to go back to traditional, what do we call them? Traditional American values, which are what? I guess that's the real question. I thought it was about equality and opportunity and inclusion and, those are the American values.
We all choose from that big mess which values we endorse and which ones we don't. Racism and genocide are also traditional American values. So I think what we want to do, what we ought to want to do, and probably what we all are trying to do in our strange ways, is to select from the past that which we wish to endorse, that which
right.
we want to use to fashion the future. And the people who make horrible threats and perform horrible actions against those who are trans are also doing that. It's simply that someone like me does not approve of the values that they choose to endorse. Your caller also made a very, very important point about this barrage of small things.
Yeah, death by a thousand cuts.
Yeah, see, authoritarian regimes don't happen all at once. They happen incrementally. the envelope gets pushed and pushed a little more and pushed a little more and pushed a little more until you have this aggregate that propels us into, you know, a fascist-style situation. When we look back at history, it seems like everything happens quickly, but it doesn't. It's a sequence of small steps. And so I think we need to be very, very, very vigilant about not getting too accustomed to the situation as it incrementally develops, you know, to push back whenever we can.
All right. Well, Beth has a question about that very thing. How do we engage in conversations? Go ahead, Beth. You're on line one.
Thank you. Yeah, Dr. Smith, I am wondering if you might have a suggestion on language that can be used to engage in these conversations to de-escalate the conflict. Because it seems as though political dialogue between people, in my experience, it doesn't exist anymore. The choice is, okay, we're going to choose to not even discuss this, which doesn't seem at all reasonable and is certainly not the American spirit. So I'm wondering if you might have some suggestions.
It's a great question. What are the solutions, Dr. Smith?
That's really hard. I wish I knew. I wish I could say this and that and everything will be okay. I think entering into those conversations, first of all, you need to have a willing conversation partner. And you need to have someone who plays by the rules of reasonable discourse. If you don't, then no conversation is possible. You can't have a one-sided conversation. You can go into a conversation with a couple of useful attitudes. One is the assumption that whomever you're talking to has some reason for the views that they have.
Absolutely.
It may be a very misconceived reason, but it's some reason. Something is leading them to the views that they have. And second, to maintain as much as possible an attitude of respect for the person. And those two things go together. And third, I guess, bearing in mind that people can change. So all too often we go into these conversations with the assumption that our interlocutor cannot change. They cannot change their mind. To enter in such conversation in that spirit, of course, you need to be prepared in principle to change your mind as well. So I think all of those things can help, but they hinge on having a conversation partner who is a genuine conversation partner, rather than someone who is simply riding into battle.
There is nothing more dangerous than an idea if it's the only one you have, right? So, and that I think is true on both sides. This isn't a bashing on of many of my fine friends and family who are more of the conservative bent and support many of the ideologies that the GOP, you know, believes in. And so I think that is to answer. I would like to add one thing to that is there's a great book called The Anatomy of Peace by the Arbinger Institute, which speaks to what you're talking about, David. How to engage in this dialogue is you must first hold the position and consider how the other person might be right. And the other premise that I always start with when I have these conversations with people, and I had one recently at a family reunion with a person who we both love to fish and we have a lot in common. And, you know, I started with the premise that I bet we want the same things and believe in the same things, right? Ardent Trump supporter and me on the other side. And we essentially identified our common values and beliefs before we got into the conflict and divided our minds into these categories of certainty, right? So that's part of it is finding your similarities in the the beliefs that are in common. So would you like to add to that?
Well, yeah, it's, I mean, that's got to be the basis for any fruitful conversation. But I think we must be very careful not to idealize these conversations. Very often, and increasingly so, these conversations are simply not possible. I think we need to face that. The degree of polarization, actually, I don't like that word because it's not explicit enough. The degree of ideological commitment is often such that this is unrealistic, and there are often very fundamental values about which there is disagreement. So it's really nice when you can find like common ground and proceed from that basis, but can't always find common ground. I mean, there are some values and beliefs that your interlocutors have which are simply utterly objectionable. And we need to face that.
All right, Alan, you're on line one. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Just a couple of thoughts and an old quote from Einstein about nationalism being an infantile disease, the measles of mankind. Mm. And also, if in any election coming up, if people are struggling with who to vote for, they might just think, who do we want as a role model? And if that's the criteria, we might get some changes.
Absolutely. That's a great point. And that is one that I have tried to argue over and over again with people that support Trump or support this sort of fear and us against them mentality. Would you want your daughters to be with someone like that? Would you want your son to grow up to be someone like that? I mean, the answer is universally no, but there's some pass for Trump. Is that authoritarianism? Is that part of this mass hysteria? Is that, or am I calling it something wrong?
Well, the leader has to be idealized. The leader has to be seen as someone with the power to deliver salvation. And for that reason, the followers are really very forgiving of the leader's quirks.
Yeah, that's it. It's not that they believe him to be perfect. It's just that it's all forgivable.
Yeah. You've got it exactly right there.
All right, Alan, that's a great point. Who do we want to be our models for our children and for our citizens? And so that speaks to, and I guess I'd like to get, as we come back from the break, because we're getting close to our last break, but I'd like to talk more, Dr. Smith, about what this is doing to the fabric of our society and the foundations that were built on. It just, the institutions that we have that are being under siege, the Justice Department, the FBI, we're losing trust in all of these, correct?
That's right.
All right. If you're just joining us, my guest today is philosophy professor Dr. David Livingstone Smith. He's the author of several books on the topic of war, genocide, dehumanization, and human cruelty. He's joined me before. If you want to check out that, you can see that on our podcast. Just go to the show page, and you can either do it on podcast on iTunes or just go to the show page and click on that link and listen to that conversation. If you want to join the conversation today, our local number is 550-8433. You can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752, and you can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll return to our discussion with Dr. David Livingstone Smith and hopefully a couple more of your calls. I'm Prentice Pemberton. This is Line 1, your health connection.
Funding for Line 1, Your Health Connection, was made possible in part by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and listeners just like you. Thank you.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just joining us, my guest today is Dr. David Livingstone Smith. He's the author of several books on the topic of war, dehumanization, and human cruelty. Today, we are talking about the political environment and the impacts it's having on our health and wellness as a nation and as a people. If you have a question or a comment for Dr. Smith, please go ahead and email us or give us a call over the next 10 minutes. Email is line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local phone number in Anchorage is 550-8433. Our toll-free number anywhere outside is 1-888-353-5752. And please remember the show repeats tonight at 8. It'll be a recording and we won't be accepting phone calls. Dr. Smith, this, the division and the polarization, I mean, part of the basic premise is, united we stand, divided we fall, one nation under God, indivisible, for liberty and justice for all, right? That's unity, that's cohesion, that is community. We are a connected people that needs to live cooperatively to have protection and safety. And right now, what is happening in our culture and our society as a result of what's happening politically in our leaders?
Yeah, well, I think the starting point is to recognize that this nation has never been unified. It's a stated ideal. But there have always been marginalized, oppressed groups who are denied justice. There have always been very powerful, very potent tensions in our society, and so on. But there is a difference between what's going on now and what went on, say, in the 50 years previously. And that is that these divisions have come to the fore and have become exacerbated. So there's always a sort of a pretense of unity, one nation under God. And that pretense often concealed disunity. But there is not a concealing now. And when you let that go, then things fragment very quickly, particularly in what I consider to be an authoritarian regime, which attacks established institutions, which are really the only glue that we have to keeping this society together.
Yeah, and it seems very fragile. Just the difference of, if I think about this investigation that's gone on for, 2 years, the Mueller investigation, and it just depends on who's in charge of Mueller as to how far he gets to dig. And I listened to the show on Watergate, and it was really about the politics and who pushed something through and who didn't protect Nixon, right? This is all fascinating stuff, and there's critical moments in our history where I think we need to be, as a people, like, what are the foundational beliefs that we want to hold true, and is our political system, do we just need to vote them all out? Somebody said vote, and I just got an email. It said, radical lying politicians of both conservative and liberal persuasions are dangerous to everyone's liberty and freedoms.
Certainly lying politicians are. Radical is a very charged word.
Yes. So is it extremism? Is that the same thing?
Yeah. And what counts as extremism depends on your perspective, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what one person considers extremism, another does not, and I don't think there's an objective metric for that. There's a tendency to take for granted the robustness of our institutions, the robustness of the protections that we have sort of baked in to our society. And that's a very, very misguided confidence. All of these things are fragile. All of these things can be undone. Germans prior to 1933 also had great confidence in the robustness of their institutions.
Right. I have another email here I wanted to read from Susan. It says, hello, does individual suffering affect the understanding of the current polarization of society and specifically with the problem of institutionalized racism? How does the capacity for empathy affect public discourse?
Oh, I think it's very important, but empathy is a two-edged sword.
Uh-huh.
Right, so if we're starting at the end of the caller's comments and work backwards, again, it depends. Empathy is always selective. Who is being empathized with? That's a first question.
Mm-hmm.
And who are those people being conceived of? So if you might have the stance that white men are under attack and extend yourself empathically to those white men, and that's going to, at least your construction of those white men, your understanding of them, and that's going to influence your attitude just as much as if you are empathic with genuinely marginalized populations, right? It's just that these two channels of empathy are going to lead you to different destinations. Of course, individual suffering influences political attitudes. I think it's very important. Individual suffering influences everything, right? Our trials and tribulations as struggling human beings have a massive effect on our entire lives. Unfortunately, Americans are generally very, very poorly educated about racism. I see this with my students. I teach a course on race and racism at the University of New England where I work. And what I hear from them more than I think any other comment is, I'm so angry I was never taught the truth about the horrible, horrible, horrible history, which to some extent is perpetuated in the present. You know, history is really in the present. It's the present is the residue of the past. And so I think we would be much healthier as a society if we could confront these things, but we've never been forced to. We've never, ever been forced to. And that feeds into our vulnerability to a populist authoritarian leader who promises to restore a glorious past, because we have not collectively been disillusioned with that image of our past.
We've chosen to see the shiny.
Yeah, exactly. American exceptionalism.
All right. Got a couple phone calls lined up here. We'll go with Joseph. You're on line one. Go ahead.
First of all, I want to thank Dr. Smith very much for his comments and his insights. And I apologize that I jumped into this in the middle of the podcast, so I haven't been listening to everything. But Dr. Smith, I would ask, in light of some of the observations that you've made, that you maybe introduce our audience to some philosophical and political thinkers that are cogent to an understanding of the direction of our current political discourse, in particular, only because I'm familiar with some of his readings and I hear some of his thoughts echoed in points that you've made. But if you could introduce the audience to the late German philosopher Carl Schmitt, S-C-H-M-I-T-T. Yeah. It sounds like you're very familiar with him, and I would love if you could maybe draw some parallels between his writings and our current political climate. And I'll take myself off the air for your answer. Thank you very much again, Doc.
Thanks, Joseph. So resources, readings, what should people look for if they want to learn more about this and educate themselves on what we're dealing with?
Oh, well, there's actually a great deal. Your caller asked about Carl Schmitt.
Yeah.
I'm by no means an expert on Carl Schmitt. In fact, I find him very difficult to read. Schmidt was a German jurist and political philosopher. He was a Nazi. And he had a particular view of the sphere of the political, which is the political is the realm of friends and enemies. And his views on the nature of politics sort of circulate around that basic conception. Schmidt is well worth reading. And some of the things he says, well, there are certainly echoes in the way the world is going now. Hannah Arendt is another philosophical thinker who is well worth reading. Her book, The Origins of Totalitarianism, for instance, really does, to some extent, speak to our times. But I think actually reading history is very important to you. Mm-hmm. Philosophers deal largely in concepts. I would recommend a book, a recently published book called How Fascism Works, which does address quite directly what's happening in the world right now. But all of this stuff takes on more life if you read the relevant history. Books like Claudia Kuntz's book, The Nazi Conscience, books on the history of American racism. There's a new book which came out. I'm reaching over on my desk to try and find it here to get the title right. I wrote a blurb for it. It's about American attitudes towards immigration. I can't give you the title offhand, unfortunately. It's called American Intolerance. Okay. That's well worth reading. So there's plenty of stuff. There's actually a lot of stuff on my website. If people go to www.davidlivingstonsmith.com.
Yeah, that website is on our show page as well, and it does have a lot of really good information, including your article, which I wanted to get to, or your essay on why we love tyrants. And German psychologist, is it Roger Money? Is it Curl?
Curl. He was British.
He was studying the Nazis, and I just wanted to read something that he wrote. Was the speeches themselves were not particularly impressive, but the crowd was unforgettable. The people seemed gradually to lose their individuality and become fueled into a not very intelligent but immensely powerful monster. Mm. Under the complete control of the figure on the rostrum, who evoked or changed its passions as easily as if they had been notes of some gigantic organ. Now, I could have gone to one of the rallies and had that same experience.
Exactly. Yes. So if people had not had the benefit of your introductory remarks to that passage, I think they very easily could have assumed that this person was talking about Donald Trump. So Roger Monicarl was a British psychoanalyst who spent some time in Vienna after World War I, and later on was invited by a friend, a German diplomat, this would have been in maybe 1932, to listen to Hitler and Goebbels campaigning for the election of 1933. And he wrote a brilliant paper on this called The Psychology of Propaganda, mm-hmm. which I'm intimately familiar with. And it's my familiarity with that paper which led me to start warning people as soon as Trump announced his candidacy back in 2015. Because I could see from that very first speech he made after he descended the escalator that his style was right out of the Nazi playbook. Now, people get very skeptical when you compare Donald Trump to Hitler.
Donald Trump is not very uncomfortable. Yes.
Donald Trump is Donald Trump. However, the rhetorical style, the rhetorical method is strikingly similar. So what did Monicarl say? He said, Hitler and Goebbels always use the same technique. The first move was to make the audience depressed. In the 1930s, it was Germany has fallen on hard times. We're the laughing stock of the world. The world is taking us for granted. We've been brought to our knees. We've betrayed our great destiny as a nation. And as Monte Carlo said, Hitler would get the audience rolling around in an orgy of self-pity. And then he would switch. He'd say, he would elicit what Monte Carlo calls paranoid anxiety. Well, it's not really you. It's the Jews, it's the communists, it's the foreigners, it's the enemies within that are eating away at the fabric of our society. And so he would get them worked up in terror, really, cultivating a state of extreme vulnerability. And then he would offer what Monte Carlo called the manic solution. Join me. Join us, join the Nazi party. We'll sweep them away with an iron broom. And there's a glorious future ahead. We'll make Germany great again. And so on and so forth.
Yeah, Dr. And Smith, so, I gotta interrupt. We're almost out of time. And I want to take Jim's call. He's got a question or a comment about fear versus rational thought. Oh, Jim is gone. How about Mary? You've been on the line for a while. Nope, she's gone too. Okay, well, I interrupted you a little bit early, but that's okay because, the propagandists, for propaganda to work, you wrote, they must elicit a sense of helplessness, the poison, magical solution, the pastry.
And part of that magical solution involves the attitude of contempt.
Yes.
See, that's the magical antidote to vulnerability. When you feel contempt, you're above them. You're looking down at them. And so when a politician elicits contempt and expresses contempt, we need to be very, very, very vigilant. And this is precisely what our president does.
So is vote the answer? Is that the take-home message here? Go out, think. Who do you want?
I think that's the best we have available. And that doesn't sound real optimistic. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe things will work out fine.
All right. Dr. Smith, I appreciate you coming and joining us again online. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. Anytime at all.
All right. If you're interested in reading more on these ideas, please remember we've posted resources on today's topic on our show page. Just go to alaskapublic.org. Click on the link to today's program. If you'd like to continue the conversation, you can join us on Facebook, and you can find that link on our website at alaskapublic.org as well. Dr. Jay Butler returns next week for a discussion about palliative care. So be sure to tune in for that conversation next Wednesday, October 31st at 10 a.m. Repeating at 8 on FM 91.1 Alaska Public Media. Eric Bork did our web editing for today's program. Dave Waldron was our audio engineer. Thanks for taking the time to join us today on Line One. Until next time, I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.